Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. This is New Books in Geography, podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Steven Siegel, coming to you from the shadows of the Rocky Mountains, and I'm the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Professor Matthew Edney about his new book, Cartography, the Ideal and Its History. The book is published by the University of Chicago Press, and it just came out in 2019. Let me welcome Matthew to the podcast. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start, if we can, by talking a little bit about how you came to be interested in geography and cartography.
Well, I was always good at geography in my British high school, and I've always loved maps. So I ended up doing a degree in geography at University College London, which had, among other things, a lot of courses in surveying. And when I turned up there, I discovered that they also had courses in a thing called historical geography. Having had history killed for me at high school by a real nasty teacher, I latched onto these things. And so my advisors didn't know what to do with me. But in my last year, I read a book chapter by Brian Harley, which revealed to me the fact that, oh, there's a thing called the history of cartography, and maybe this is how I can unify the two sides of my interests. My undergraduate advisor mentioned to me David Woodward at the University of Wisconsin, who turned out to have money. And so the next thing I know, in 1983, I'm newly enrolled grad student at University of Wisconsin at Madison, working for the project.
And I remember when I was a graduate student beginning and reading your books about India and the history of the British Empire. Is there a way that you moved from studying the British Empire and the history of India into this larger project or the series of larger projects on 18th and 19th century cartography?
I don't think I've ever given up my interest in surveying. That's what when I began graduate school, I focused on histories of surveying and institutional history is whether my master's degree on late 19th century U.S. federal government surveys or my PhD on the British surveys in India. But there's always a sense in surveying that it's about a process. And as I developed that work and after I got my degree, I started thinking in terms of the differences between what are often lumped together as sort of two flavors of cartography, surveying and mapping. You know, the lower resolution mapping, higher resolution surveys. And I started developing some ideas in the 1990s about the way in which cartography is really split among quite a few discrete, what I call modes of cartography, such that somebody working in geography and geographical mapping really has nothing in common institutionally in terms of knowledge constructs, ideas of space, with somebody working in a property mapper, let's say, surveying property boundaries, and the other extreme. So you can start to see that there are these discrete groups of people, groups of mapping, ways of understanding the world, and the practices that they engender to map them, so that you end up with quite distinct modes. And that sort of stuck with me. And as I've worked through, and as my span of interest has gotten bigger, as I've tried to think about how to tell the history of cartography over time without succumbing to some simplistic ideas of progress, I found it best to think always about the discrete mode. So when I was writing about mapping in the British Atlantic, for example, for one of these big handbooks, it was best to do it in terms of marine mapping as one kind of mapping, regional mapping as another, and property mapping as a third. And so, and keeping them quite distinct allowed me to make a more sophisticated argument than would otherwise have been the case. And so this is very much what ends up informing the current project.
Yes, and I think if I can ask you a little bit about these modes and the ideal as you describe it in the history of cartography, one of the fascinating points that I think you make about the idea of historical geography or the history of maps and mapping is a fundamental argument, which I see in many respects as a warning. First, as a warning against progress, that there is a cartography without progress that needs to be described. And second, one of your biggest arguments in the book, which I'd ask you to explain a little bit more, is the processual approach to map studies, in which you say that nothing about cartography can be taken for granted. So what is this processual approach that you describe?
Okay. Well, let me back up a bit and do a bit of personal autobiography, which comes into lecture biography. So the initial idea, when in 1993 I wrote this article called Cartography Without Progress, the idea then in my head was that cartographic modes are distinct, not very many, and relatively predictable and explanatory. They can be used to explain things. But as my work has developed, and as I've thought about this more and more, modes are actually a pretty crude way of cutting apart the different kinds of mapping that are undertaken. They're really just a heuristic. It's like class or what have you. I mean, they allow us to talk about different kinds of mapping, but in and of themselves, they don't really have any explanatory power. They don't tell us anything about how history has evolved, mapping has evolved and developed over time. So I realized, being a good Foucauldian, that really what we've got is lots and lots and lots and lots, I mean, I don't know, infinite number, of spatial discourses in which people are coming together, maybe literally just one or two people, three people, maybe much larger indiscriminate networks of print in the more modern age. But there are spatial discourses in which people are trying to understand and communicate about spatial complexities. I should say I use spatial complexity as a shorthand simply because if spatial relationships aren't complex, there's no need to communicate them. So there's no need to try to represent those relationships in some kind of way. And so from the ground up, you can discern if you are very, you can do it easily present. It's very hard to do it historically because you need to find the evidence for it. But you can certainly identify particular precise spatial discourses. And then you can look at the kinds of strategies that those discourses support for representing spatial complexity, whether we're talking about installations built into the environment, verbal maps, various forms of graphics, numbers, and so on. These are all different strategies that are used in different ways within different discourses. So one example of this I've unearthed, in the early 19th century, there was a move in the city of Portland, Maine, to map the city, not for engineering purposes, not for navigational purposes, but really for the purpose of creating a sense of identity, a sense of place for a city that was under a great deal of change for several decades. And in this particular process, there was maps were being produced, urban maps of the city, locally for local consumption, and they rapidly developed and sustained a very particular set of graphic conventions. The center of the old part of Portland is on a peninsula. And so this peninsula actually runs northeast, southwest. But very, very quickly, I mean, almost immediately, the peninsula was mapped as running across the page in order to maximize space. And so there's a compass rose of some sort placed in the river, in the harbor. And then also in the harbor is the list of places mentioned on the map, because these are relatively small. And this format, this sort of internal, utterly local set of conventions persists through the 1830s, 1840s until a group of Philadelphia-based publishers start to produce local maps, again, for local consumption, but they're doing it in larger numbers with on bigger presses and larger wall maps that are being and so the mapping itself, the map production work is being done in Philadelphia. So these Philadelphia-based map makers are trying to make maps of interest to the locality, of interest to local people. And they do have a lot of local identity forming features, and they, I mean, not least of which is their large wall maps in the 1850s that stuck on the walls to say, hey, this is my city. But the kicker is that in this shift, the Philadelphia merchants, map makers, start to use newly professionalized civil engineers, and they start to follow what they think maps should be like. And so one of those criteria for both civil engineers and for these map makers is that north should be at the top of the page. And so the peninsula angles up, which requires a much larger sheet of paper and a lot of white space. And they try to show the footprints of buildings in a good engineering way. So the list of churches and schools and courthouses and all the rest of the things that show the morality and the civility of this town disappear from a legend and get sort of integrated into the map in a very difficult way to read the character of the city from. So just in that period from about 1815 to 1851 in particular, there's a very particular spatial discourse that the pretty well-off people within Portland are engaging in. in a very small environment in a very particular way. It's really hard to find that kind of spatial discourse and to delineate it with ease. What are easier to find are what I think of now as threads of discourse. So, for example, roadmaps. Road mapping is broadly a sort of a regional mapping of space, but with a very particular purpose. And so you've got different kinds of roadmaps being produced at different times in different communities, different systems, depending on how the economy is functioning and how society is functioning and technologically is going. So, and then you can start seeing how these various threads of discourse sort of combine into these larger modes. So the mode becomes a heuristic, but the real level of study is at this discursive level, whether at the individual discourse or at the larger threads of discourse, which we discern much more easily, certainly historically. And this is where process comes in, because what these discourses are doing is within each of these discourses, threads, you've got the production and the consumption. In between, you've got the circulation of maps. So mapping processes, production, circulation, and consumption, all have to be studied equally to understand the shape of these various discourses and threads of discourse. And this is different from older forms of map history. You know, traditional sort of pre-1980 forms are very much emphasizing production, how maps are made. The big change in sociocultural work was, after 1980, was to bring much more attention, if not entire attention, on consumption. How do people interpret these maps? What a processual approach does is say production's important, consumption's important, and in between, circulation is as important as the other two.
Yes, and I think that in mentioning the point about circulation, I'd actually really like to ask you more about cartography's ideal. And I think the example that you provide of the community of Portland and the producers in Philadelphia is perfect for explaining this. I've noticed in doing my own work on Imperial Russia and on Central and Eastern Europe that there has been, among what you call the sociocultural intellectual whack-a-mole people, who have really focused on the consumption side, that there's a real hesitation to focus on biography. There's a real hesitation, I think, to even get rid of the ideal of cartography itself. So I wondered if I could talk to you a little bit for our listeners about the whole what is a map question and how that might be a misleading question from the start if you're examining all of these modes and all of these actors at once.
Sure. So ever since the word cartography was coined in the early 19th century, it's been understood to mean, you know, the entire endeavor of map making. So when academics, starting really in the 60s, began to really wonder, okay, so what is a map? What is the nature of this newly forming discipline called academic cartography? The way that they thought, well, we can define cartography is by defining what a map is, because cartography is just map making. So what are these maps that we make? How does that then shape our field and define our field, if not legitimate us as academics? And ever since then, the arguments, the debates within cartography and about cartography, almost immediately, as soon as somebody starts talking about there's this field called cartography, the debate immediately flips to, well, what's a map? And what nobody has realized, not even me until I finally got it into my head working on this book, is that nobody's actually said, nobody's asked, why is it that we think that there is a category of things, a phenomena, that we can unambiguously say, this is a map, that is not a map. Admittedly, some people have a bit of ambiguity in there, but we have this sense, every time we talk about maps do things, we talk about the map, we have this sense that there is a single category of phenomena that everyone can agree upon are maps. The question is, has become, especially for social cultural students of maps, how do we define these maps as cultural documents, as social instruments, in such a way that we can maintain this comprehensive category of phenomena? And what I would argue is now is that belief in this single and unambiguous category is actually an aspect of an idealization that is cartography. Cartography, the word cartography was coined in particular by a Danish expatriate in Paris, Conrad Malbrun, who was trying a new word for a new understanding of mapping that comes out of the 18th century, in particular in the work of the French, that seemed to hold promise as being sort of a universal form of mapping. You've heard, I'm sure, of the 18th century French Cassini map of France, or the Carte de France. When Cassini III first printed these maps in about 1760, those sheets, he called these maps, the individual sheets forming the general and particular map of France.
That's right.
I won't throw out my execrable French accent. That's to say, they are at once very particular, focused on details of a landscape, but at the same time, it's a general map. Is covering a huge region. And because it has this triangulation framework, so everything is fixed very nicely, you can theoretically use this framework as the basis for coastal mapping, and then with new technologies, you can do inshore hydrographic work very easily. And you can use this framework as the basis for cadastral taxation mapping and navigation engineering mapping for building roads and military mapping, plus general touristic traveling needs. There's a sense when Malbrun first uses the word, and as this concept of mapping of cartography develops, that people think that if only we can implement it, if only we have the money and the staffing and skill sets to actually implement it, we could have a single survey that meets all needs. The needs of the public, the needs of government, the needs of all the different parts of the government. Mariners, landlubbers, everybody. And that's what in the 1820s gets picked up as cartography. It's very much as ideal of sort of a vision, an aspirational vision of what mapping should be, especially after it became very apparent that the 18th century claims to a universal mapping technique, which is fit everything within latitude-longitude frameworks by geographers, very, very quickly in the early 19th century became exposed as not really working for the more detailed military-based surveys that European states were doing in Europe and empires. So this concept of cartography develops, first from these systematic surveys and then through a whole series of various factors through the 19th century, each of which either reinforces existing points or creates new points, new preconceptions, new convictions about the way maps should be. So the systematic territorial survey comes sort of influences of what we can call an ontological preconception that maps are properly properly statements of fact. And the idea of observation or going out into the landscape and drawing the hills in a planimetric view underpins concepts that maps are pictures, allow you to see things, especially when balloons and the like, panoramas come into use. By the end of the century, as people are engaging in mass mobility for the first time with bicycles and with cars, very, very early automobiles, there develops this sense that all maps are about navigation, about guiding people as they move through space. All of these different preconceptions stem from practice. They stem from how people have made and used and circulated maps, not from a logical process. And so we have this undeniable fact that some of these things are contradictory, but it doesn't matter. So when sociocultural scholars, when a sociocultural approach developed in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, scholars were worried about the idea of a map as simply being a statement of fact, an objective statement. And they were trying to critique that and point out, no, there's cultural meanings associated with it. And they're done to sustain power and power relations. They start knocking down inadvertently some of the preconceptions of the ideal of cartography, but other ones survive. So in the book, I quote a recent instance where a couple of very well-respected and established scholars say, no, we reject the idea that maps are pictures. Great. That's a pictorial preconception kicked out the window. And then he immediately turned around and said, maps are propositions about location, which just brings up the ontological preconception once again. So this is what I call the intellectual whack-a-mole process of sociocultural critique. Because the sociocultural critique has addressed the map, or the concept is this mythical thing called the map, rather than this body of belief, this hegemonic belief system that is the ideal of cartography. We've kept on, and I say we, because I've been very much part of this myself, we've turned over some of the basic tenets of the ideal only to fall foul of some of the other ones. It's been very hard to get away because nobody's understood that cartography doesn't actually exist. I stole from Stephen Schaefer a phrase from my epigraph for chapter one. There's no such thing as cartography, and this is a book about it. Cartography is, for Baudrillard, is a simulacrum. It's the image not of a, is an image that doesn't hide truth, is an image that hides the fact that there is no truth. And the simulacrum is a product of historical forces. It has evolved. It has developed in the 19th and 20th century because of certain social, cultural trends. And I could go on about this stuff till the cows come home, but you should read the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, I think everybody should read the book as a place to start. And I would add to this because in reading some of the works that have come out by Dennis Wood and John Fels and John Pickles and, of course, Marc Monmonier, really from the 80s and 90s, I do see you bringing up many of the older arguments, but advancing many of the newer arguments to bring geography closer to history. And as a historian and not as a geographer, I wonder if we might talk a little bit about the dark side of cartography and the dark side of empire. And I don't just mean just postmodernism or post-structuralist critique or even post-colonial studies, but is there some way we can begin as historians and geographers, and as you once put it to me, refugees from GIS, to try and incorporate the insights and the contributions of these schools of thought? I do see you pushing the field, if we can call it that, closer to spatial discourse studies and maybe closer to Baudrillard's understanding of simulacrum. I myself end up leaning closer toward graphic designers and artists and surrealists rather than the old world of positivist-oriented topographers and engineers and surveyors. But I guess my question would be, where are you pushing historians of geography and cartography toward if we've lost the ideal and we've lost this, as you say, a kind of isolationist understanding of cartography and the map itself?
Good question. In large part, I'm reacting to a very negative attitude towards maps and cartography that evolved in the 60s and 70s. This is what Martin Bruckner once called the maps are bad syndrome. And it's something that Brian Hiley pushed. It's implicit in all sorts of approaches. And the critique has been is valid to the extent that it is a critique of the intellectual underpinnings of cartography, is invalid in that it thinks that these are completely implemented. So one of the complaints is that cartography is utterly sexist, is utterly racist, and it sustains sort of Western imperial ideologies, which is, on the face of it, absolutely the case. The ideal cartography, one of its preconceptions, the individualistic preconception, holds for reasons that I really don't know why anybody believed in the first place, but they did, that the cognitive neurological knowledge that we have in our individual heads, that some people misleadingly call the cognitive map, because it's not really a map, is somehow directly expressed in graphic form. That what a cartographer does is take his or her, most his knowledge of the world and present it in a graphic format. And this has led to a great deal of, frankly, I think, misleading. I mean, it's a huge amount of work. It's utterly wrong, I would say, that Westerners think in rational ways. This goes back to all the errors within Piaget's cognitive psychology, in which he used imperial ethnographic work as a way to justify that these primitive, childlike, I'm using scare quotes, childlike peoples are thinking about space topologically, whereas our Western youth, as they get to adulthood, think rationally, think in terms of a geometric, ordered, gridded space. Which means that anybody who thinks topologically, who draws a map topologically, which is how anybody would draw a map if you're trying to tell a friend how to get from where you are to where the party is. Anybody who draws a topological map must therefore be not as cognitively developed as those of us in the West. And so men get, white men get promoted to a higher rank, and the indigenous other gets demoted to some kind of childlike state. And in between, women occupy this strange liminal position where they're able, because they're intuitive, not rational, again, scare quotes, they can interact with the native, but at the same time, they're from Western civilization, so they've got some sense of rationality. This is a huge body of absolute rot built up around these kinds of concepts that underpins the idea that cartography is, well, the mapping is necessarily sexist, racist, so on. Cartography in the ideal, the way in which people have deployed the idea of cartography to sustain what Western legitimization of empire, to sustain the sort of power relationships between ethnic groups within Western society. Those are part of this mythic practice, this concept of cartography, not how people actually make maps. So what I want to see is, by people looking not at mapping through the lens, this flawed, distorted lens of cartography, but to look at mapping practices, processes, what exactly are people doing, then what happens is that the role of the map maker as the great producer of knowledge evaporates. You know, one of the issues that you see, Dennis Cosgrove wrote about it, Gillian Rose has done this too. I mean, these are both, you know, incredibly great thinkers and writers. But, you know, Cosgrove says, you know, there's a pre-map period of analysis and there's the post-map period of analysis. So somehow there's a body of creation of the map, and somehow that is then fixed the moment the map is physically made, and then the map is used. And Gillian Rose said the same thing in terms of images generally. There's sort of the pre-image, the image, and the post-image practices. But if you think about circulation, maps are circulating within discourses. Maps themselves are one of the things that are circulating, not the knowledge in the map, but the maps themselves. And they're circulating between producers and consumers. Everybody within that discourse is using the same semiotic system that's appropriate to that discourse. One of the things that actually led me in this whole direction was a very simple throwaway statement by an historian of the English language, Jeremy Smith, who said that the users of a system, of a linguistic system, blah, 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 blah. And by users of a linguistic system, he meant the speakers, the listeners, the writers, the readers, everybody who partakes in the linguistic system. It's not that we've got map makers on one side and map users on the other side. Is that within the shape, within the scope of the little precise discourses, producers and consumers are all partaking in the same semiotic system. So it's not that the map maker defines the meaning of a map. It's more that map meanings are created through this circulation of imagery and their consumption of imagery within very particular historical circumstances, which is very much in line with the kinds of arguments that Martin Dodge, Chris Perkins, and Rob Kitchen have been arguing about in terms of the idea that, you know, fundamentally from a postmodern point of view. Reading is meaning in a text is created by the reader, not the producer. So how do we understand the reading purely idiosyncratic from readings that are more culturally valid? Well, that's the question for tracing through discourses, for looking at the ways in which maps circulate, so you can start to figure out the kinds of people, men, women, whites, blacks, rich, poor, whatever kind of axes you're going to use, which kinds of people are interpreting maps and what kind of conditions and what kind of results generate from that as these things are circulating around. So what I'm pushing for is, in effect, a complete disintegration of the idea of cartography. Not only should we not talk about cartography, we should not even use the word, but more particularly, we need to ditch all the concepts of universality that come from this mythic ideal. And instead, get down in the weeds, and this is where my historical side comes out, and look at the evidence. How are people actually using maps in these kind of contexts, particular times, and how are these maps circulating around, combining, connecting producers and consumers within the same linguistic semiotic system? And if you do that, then you can start to do work that's starting to be done, certainly in history, that is looking at the role of spatial knowledge in historical processes. And there's two great books that come to mind immediately. One is Jeffers Lennox's book on colonial Nova Scotia, where he starts out with this whole concept of realization, I should say, that Nova Scotia is a 19th century creation, the limits and extent. And the way that the history of Nova Scotia had been written has always been as this sterile container for events, as landscape, what Paul Carter called imperial history. So what he did is to start figuring through both written maps, written memoranda, what we know about oral histories, to understand the different sets of knowledge and concepts of the peninsula and the neighboring mainland held by not just the English in Nova Scotia and the Mi'kmaq peoples and French Acadians, but also by other Wabanakis who were relatively hostile to the Mi'kmaq, the cosmopolitan French in Paris, the less cosmopolitan but still bureaucratic French in Quebec, and the English in Boston and the English in London. All of these different groups have differing sets of spatial understandings of this territory. And you can retell a much more sophisticated history of the colonial development of Nova Scotia in the conflict between the three sets of people on the ground, the Indians, the English, and the French, by understanding more of the processes by how information circulated in various forms. The other book and I'm blanking, this is really embarrassing, I'm blanking on his name. His last name is Mapp. He's a William and Mary, wrote a great book on the American West, where he's, again, looking at people's understandings of space through various discourses at various discursive levels in order to retell the history of the early expansion West. You might also add to that David Bernstein's recent book, How the West Was Drawn, where he's trying to understand white Plains Indian relationships and the events of dispossession of the Sioux, Pawnee in particular, the Iowa, through their spatial interactions, as it were. The result is what Paul Carter, back in 1987, called spatial history, rather than treating landscape as being the empty stage on which history unfolds, the territory itself is a concept that's part of history, and it also unfolds with the events of history and has a significant impact on those events. So my vision then is really to promote an understanding that is empirically sound, that does open spaces for previously cartographically disadvantaged peoples, women, minorities in particular, and to both to recover their work so it's no longer obscure, but at the same time to contextualize the work of state agencies in the mapping of who knows how many different aspects of territory. Does that make sense?
And I think actually, if I can add a couple of things to this, because one of the most fascinating parts I found about your book was your checklist of wrong convictions. I actually really love this in the middle of chapter three, because I think, and I'll just read some of them. You mention ontology, the map is a reduction of the world or archive. Pictorialness, the map is an unmediated graphic mimetic presentation of the world. Individuality, you also touch upon this in our talk. Making maps and using maps are acts solely of individual cognition. And you mentioned Piaget as well. Materiality, maps are things made at a specific moment. Observation, especially with this default of topography and relief and landscape, that all maps are grounded in observation and measurement. I wondered if I could just ask you a little bit about this word convictions that you use. You've mentioned practices and understanding the marginalized communities and wanting to know more about their systems of spatial discourse. But what do you mean by convictions or moreover wrong convictions? You're insisting on something there that's normative. What is it?
Right. So it's actually very straightforward. I started identifying these big, broad preconceptions when I was trying to figure out why everybody who's written about John Smith's, here at Pocahontas fame, John Smith's map of New England, Boeotian New England, 1614, how everybody who wrote about it for 200 years got the story wrong, even completely contradicting the reliable empirical evidence. And there's not much of it. The evidence says X, and every historian says not X. It's quite amazing. And so I developed this, I began to see these larger preconceptions, which really, again, they're heuristic in the sense that they seem to be principles that everybody subscribed to, in the sense of, because this is the ideal through all these, shaped from all these different preconceptions. But the convictions are simply just sort of subparts, very particular concepts that come from the larger preconceptions or even from combinations of preconceptions. So, for example, under pictorialness, the way that a map seems to be a particular kind of picture requires several convictions or engenders several convictions that maps are graphic images, whereas maps can be verbal, they can be tectonic, built into the environment, numeric, what have you. And then there are combinations as well. And that another conviction stemming from the pictorialness is that cartography has its own distinctive special language. Over the last 120 years or so, people have been writing about the cartographic language as being somehow distinct from other semiotic systems, when in reality, the maps are extrusions, extensions of their particular discourses. So A conviction in this sense is simply a particular point that gets repeated over the last, certainly the last 100 years, if not the last 200 years, depending on the degree of the evolution of the ideal, and is still very commonly expressed in a wide array of literature, academic and popular. The checklist itself is there because I realized that a lot of these convictions might get lost in the diatribe that is chapter three.
Right. Diatribe is a good word.
Yeah. Yes. It's a rant, I must admit. But in many respects, the whole book is a rant. I've tried not to be ad hominem in any particular location. And I've also ensured that, you know, when I see errors in my own work, that I've noted those as well.
Yeah, and I actually, I want to say illuminating diatribe, because I remember reading all of the satirists. People, especially in writing map books, tend to quote anecdotally from Jonathan Swift or Mark Twain or Lewis Carroll or Borges. But I get kind of irritated because I then keep seeing those same quotes over and over again. And I, like you, in many ways, I feel the inclination to rant, to see people actually begin to develop more of a sustained critique from the humor and the oddity and the throwaway quotes and phrases. So if I may ask you as a kind of a last question, is there a counter-hegemonic or maybe a citizen-based way, not an ideal, but perhaps a set of practices out of the degenerate ideal of cartography? And what would that be?
Well, I don't think, to begin with, that the satires themselves are necessarily counter-hegemonic. Certainly, you know, Lewis Carroll with the whole idea of a map of one-to-one, which hasn't been used yet. Farmers objected, said it would shut out all the sunlight. Those are really playing with contradictions between preconceptions. So that their indications, their existence are indications that a wide community of the public have some understanding, at least, of the preconceptions of the ideal. The maps are supposed to be accurate, definitive statements that are used for navigation, and so on. Having said that, I think it's really a question of dispelling concepts of cartography and everything that stems from it, and focusing more on mapping as the process by which groups of people come together and talk about, negotiate over matters of spatial concern. I don't say that mapping is sexist. Cartography is sexist. Cartography is imperialistic, and so on. Actual individual mapping activities are not necessarily, they can be, but they're not necessarily sexist, racist, imperialistic, what have you. So in a way, I'm sort of arguing for an extended feminist approach to mapping, in the sense that in feminism, it's asking for equal rights for everybody. Social inequalities, whether they're economic, gender, what have you, need to be eliminated or at least ameliorated. And I think the same kind of thing can be done in everyday mapping activities. I mean, this is what the critical cartography movement and critical GIS movements are all about today, in terms of ensuring that locals are involved in an urban GIS, and the decisions that come from it. The counter-mapping practices of trying to integrate indigenous knowledges into a modern GIS or modern map that can then be understood by remote decision makers and acted upon as a valid body of knowledge because it's presented in a very modern, formal right. kind of way.
Right.
And to teach indigenous peoples modern mapping technology so that they can interact on their terms more equally with bureaucratic central administration. So I think it's a question of practice. It's nothing about the mapping per se that is going to promote a feminist point of view, other than just sort of making quite sure that as many stakeholders as possible can be included in mapping practices as we move forward.
And I think now that we've taken up a lot of your time, Matthew, I'll ask you our traditional question on new books in history and new books in geography. What are you working on now?
Well, Cartography, the Ideal and its History is actually the first of three books that all came out of the same big practice, same big project, which just grew and grew and grew as I realized that the answers weren't quite as straightforward as I thought they would be to begin with. And so the next book is called Mapping History Theory. And so it's partly, it's an historiography of map history, looking at how there have been multiple historiographical communities, historiographical modes of map history that came together in the 60s and 70s, and in large respect, prompted the sociocultural critique of the map. And then to trace through that critique and to reveal how, even as it's trying to disabuse the concept of normative map, nonetheless, the sociocultural critique has remained indebted to the ideal of cartography within the particular context of claims, right, the history of cartography. And that then leads up to the third book, eventually, which would be called Mapping as a Process.
Wow.
Just as a final plug, I should say, if you go to mappingasprocess.net, that's the blog where I'm trying to work on some of these ideas.
And this is a blog that I follow avidly. So go to it, our listeners, read it. You'll get a quick preview of what Professor Matthew Edney is working on next. I want to thank him and his book. If we're talking about his book today, the book is called Cartography, the Ideal and Its History. It's by Matthew H. Edney, and it's published in 2019 by University of Chicago Press. I want to thank you, Matthew, for being on our show today.
Well, again, thank you for having me.